2. From Gobbo to G395. Nicola Gobbo, student and spy, 1972 to 1998. It didn't have to go like this. Nicola Gobbo was gifted status by virtue of her unusual surname. Her uncle, Sir James Gobbo, was a Supreme Court judge, human rights advocate, and Victoria's governor, an exemplar of diligence and dignity. Gobbo should have been a lifelong passport to respect. But this Gobbo was drawn to notoriety. Something was missing. She wasn't like the other Gobbos. The image she presented conflicted with her motives. Investigating Gobbo's childhood feels like a form of archaeology, with clues to her early life buried like ancient artifacts. She was born in Melbourne in November 1972, a Scorpio, in the Chinese year of the rat. Her father, Alan, was first-generation Italian. His family claimed that they had brought the first espresso machine to Australia in the 1930s. Gobbo herself learned Italian and probably drew on her European heritage in later years. Parts of Melbourne's underworld were loosely divided into ethnicities, such as Lebanese and Italian. In that world, her family background, both for its cultural origins and legal reputation, bought her credibility. Alan Gobbo worked at Vic Roads. He and his second wife, Mary, a nurse, lived with their children in the affluent eastern suburb of Kew. In a 2019 TV interview, Gobbo herself emphasised the family bonds, describing her parents as hard-working and old-fashioned. Gobbo told the ABC's 7:30 she was one of five children. She was close to her half-sister, Linda. Her younger full-sister, Catherine, followed Gobbo into the law. Their choice seemed almost fated, considering the achievements and reputation of Alan's brother, Sir James. Gobbo had wanted to be a lawyer since childhood, she wrote in 1996, because she had been instilled with a strong sense of social justice in a family with an established legal background. Gobbo's early life can be glimpsed only from afar. A family photo here, a school report there, just enough to provide impressions of happiness and stability. Faded photos she supplied to the ABC depicted Melbourne suburbia and childhood pleasures. They're remarkable for their ordinariness. Summer days floating on a plastic tube in a backyard pool, red stains around the mouth from eating watermelon, a beach snap, perhaps from a 1970s Gold Coast, alongside a man, presumably her father. In what appears to be a communion photo, she has her hands clasped, her dress starchy white, in keeping with Roman Catholic custom. Gobbo was remembered as a big unit at Genazzano College, a Catholic girls' school in Melbourne's leafy east, where she finished Year 12 in 1990. A school report, in which she was given an A, said Gobbo was reliable and eager to please. Gobbo liked footy and regularly attended games of her VFL-AFL club Fitzroy with a schoolmate. Decades later, her school friends do not want to be publicly associated with her. Her nickname was Smurf, after the tiny cartoon characters, yet she stood out in every class photo for her size, like a woman dressed as a girl. Despite the frenetic lifestyle she later adopted and the unbearable stresses she endured, she remained large-framed throughout most of her adulthood. She was always comfortable as the centre of attention. Take the time a fellow school student drew a lewd reference on a classroom blackboard about Gobbo's supposed sexual encounters with a celebrity. Gobbo rubbed the image out, but she seemed pleased about the tittering. Gobbo was a polariser. You either played as her audience or you avoided her. I don't think she opened up to anyone about anything, a fellow student would tell Carlyon. By her final year, she was a regular at nightclubs, probably using a fake ID to gain entry, like many other Genazzano girls. Melbourne was slumping into recession, and though many of their parents would lose long-held fortunes, the private school kids of Melbourne's inner eastern bubble didn't appear to care. Clutches of Genizano girls headed to Toc H, a Toorak hotspot, for $1 drinks on Thursday nights. Carlyon, who went to a nearby boys' school, never met Gobbo there. He recalls bad karaoke and drunken pashes. Gobbo was more promiscuous than the others. At least she said she was. On Mondays, she told schoolmates of intimate encounters with bouncers and celebrities at the city's Tunnel nightclub, from which patrons stumbled into the inky dawn. These tawdry tales were the dark half of her double life. In the other, Gobbo was a prefect and house captain. She was also an exceptional student. In her final year, she sometimes took over the legal studies classes at Genizano College, mostly because she seemed better informed than the teacher. Yet at the same time, she faced a personal crisis, the death of her father, Alan. Gobbo might not have excelled at deep friendships, but many of her school peers attended the funeral. Alan Gobbo had survived 5 years after a cancer diagnosis gave him only a short time left. Throughout, Gobbo had feared her father had only days or weeks to live. She and her siblings bonded through trauma. Gobbo's Year 12 marks were outstanding, yet not high enough to qualify for law at the University of Melbourne, or so it's said. Gobbo once compared university entry scores with a fellow first-year student destined for high political office. He pointed out that her score did not meet the university's requirements. It's possible she applied for and received special consideration for her recent bereavement, but she offered her fellow student another reason for her acceptance to the prestigious university. "My name is Gobbo." Law was an easy choice. She was proud of the Gobbo heritage, and a law degree would be the basis for a public role in society. Gobbo had strong views on sport and politics. She would be heard no matter what forum she landed in. She thrived on a happening university campus. There was a chocolate appreciation society and 7 or 8 pubs nearby. The Clyde, in nearby Cardigan Street, bounced most weeknights. Even impoverished students could guzzle $1 pots of beer. The law fraternity initiated PTNs, pleasant Thursday nights. Gobbo sculled spirits in order to be seen doing so. She was always there, the tall blonde with the pancake makeup. One former law student recalls his first sighting of Gobbo when she walked into a room and announced, "I'm Nicola Gobbo, I'm a nymphomaniac," then walked out again. She didn't appear classy, another fellow student recalls. She didn't sound privileged, even if she projected an air of entitlement. She swore as if for effect. "She was a show-off," one of her peers would tell Carlyon. "She always wanted you to know that she was a Gobbo." Gobbo went to Tunnel nightclub too, and she was there in 1991 when Collingwood footballer Darren Mullane drank heavily, drove into a parked truck, and died. His coronial inquest followed a funeral attended by 5,000 or more grieving football fans. Gobbo gave evidence that Mullane didn't appear to know where he was or what he was doing, in testimony accepted as the true course of events. Here was Gobbo's first embrace of public notoriety. She was telling the world that she frequented all-night clubs and befriended footballers, a perch at odds with her straight-laced upbringing. Academically, she took a while to find her way. In her first year at university, she withdrew from Economics 1A and failed Australia in the global economy and switched from commerce law to arts law. For her law degree, Gobbo studied criminology and a range of criminal law subjects, perhaps already certain of her future trajectory. She even served as vice president of the law school. Among her fellow students were numerous future luminaries, including Peter Credlin, described as the country's most powerful woman during her time as Prime Minister Tony Abbott's chief of staff. Gobbo had ambitions to become Prime Minister herself. Her star burned brightly, perhaps too brightly, She seemed daubed with the glow of a shiny future. Immersing herself in the hotbed of student politics and its petty agendas, Gobbo ran for election as co-editor of the university's student newspaper, Farrago. She'd already done a 4-week stint in the business section of the Herald and Weekly Times after she finished school, where she was remembered as good company, always up for drinks, and for name-dropping her uncle. Editing Farrago was often seen as a stepping stone to journalism or political office, a natural stop for a girl who wanted to be prime minister. Gobbo ran on a rescue Farrago ticket and was elected with 3 female Jewish peers. She was later accused of breaching election regulations, perhaps the first time she was called upon to defend prohibited conduct. She explained that her Farrago ticket had been subjected to anti-Semitic harassment and played the patronizing victim card. In essence, my alleged breach of regulations amounted to nothing. Perhaps the allegations were partly due to the frayed tempers and highly charged emotions of all involved, she wrote in 1997 in an application to be accepted as a solicitor. Co-editing Farrago was a real job, 60 to 70 hours a week. Gobbo wrote topical stories in the tone of a cub reporter, with sprinklings of analysis. Her newspaper photo featured a toothy smile, big earrings, and big hair. Like all student newspapers, Farrago attracted controversy for its political stances. At the time, Gobbo was a Labour Party supporter, at odds with the Kennett government, which later appointed her uncle as governor. A letter she wrote as a Year 12 schoolgirl decrying the ALP's overthrow of Premier John Kane had been published in the Herald Sun. She sounded starstruck in a Farrago interview with New South Wales Labour leader Bob Carr. Carr is one MP who has maintained his integrity and commitment both to his party and his own ideals through many years of political involvement. But it wasn't all about politics. As Gobbo wrote in an article headlined, "The Place to Find a Well-Hung Jury," if the dancing frenzy and amount of alcohol consumed are any indication of future legal prowess, then those at the 1993 Law Ball will constitute an impressive addition to the profession. While negotiating this whirl of socialising and student politics, Gobbo completed her degree, albeit with mainly average results. At least she nailed her final law subject. Somewhat ironically, considering her future path in life, her only first-class honour in 5 years was in legal ethics and professional conduct. She toyed with the idea of a thesis about police informing, and she was certainly well-placed to address the subject. At the time, she was already pursuing a double life. She was a law student and she was a police informer. It was 1993 AFL Grand Final day, and Melbourne was talking about that goal. Michael Long bounced the ball 4 times while weaving past opponents to produce one of the most memorable moments in Essendon's premiership win over Carlton. Nicola Gobbo had weightier concerns. A third-year law student at the University of Melbourne, she lived in nearby Carlton with her housemate, Brian Wilson. Wilson was a nightclub bouncer and drug trafficker, thought to have a sideline in guns. Dowsley and Carl Lyon have been told he was close to underworld drug king Mark Moran. He was the first bad man on Gobbo's lifelong list of bad men. They met through the rock band INXS. Wilson was working as an after-hours security guard at the University of Melbourne when INXS performed there for the first time, a few years after the band released the single Suicide Blonde. Gobbo, as a Farrago reporter and co-editor, was lined up to interview the lead singer, Michael Hutchence. It's unclear whether the interview happened, but the arrangement led to Wilson becoming Gobbo's housemate and property co-owner. She wanted someone to help pay the mortgage on her house, but she and Wilson also fell into a sexual relationship. Sometime later, around August 1993, someone had tipped off the police about Wilson's illegal activities. After 2 weeks of surveillance, officers raided the Rathdown Street home he and Gobbo shared, a single-fronted terrace squeezed between bigger properties. A pungent aroma engulfed police officers when they entered late on the afternoon of Friday the 3rd of September, 3 weeks before Grand Final Day. A 20-litre drum filled with marijuana heads sat in the lounge room. Wilson was home. He was handcuffed and told to sit. Gobbo arrived almost 2 hours later. In the interim, police had searched for amphetamines, checking all the usual places, finding almost nothing. Sergeant Trevor Ashton, the officer leading the raid, spoke to Gobbo in her bedroom. He had discovered a cigarette packet in her chest of drawers containing a small amount of amphetamine. Gobbo immediately directed him to air vents in the laundry. They were easy to miss. Secreted inside the vents were big bags of white powder, which Gobbo explained were Wilson's and not hers. Who knows if the police would have found the amphetamine without Gobbo's, as Ashton would put it in 2019, willing assistance. Wilson was charged with drug trafficking, Gobbo with use and possession. Now, this was a problem. A criminal conviction can be a life changer for anyone, but especially so for an aspiring lawyer. If convicted, Gobbo might fail the character requirements of the Legal Admissions Board. Her career would be crueled before it began. What was said and agreed to in Gobbo's conversations with police after her arrest in 1993 is unknown. The officers involved had little memory of the incident when cross-examined 25 years later. At least one of them is still miffed that Gobbo was not charged with trafficking. Under the law, she was in possession of 1.4 kilograms, a trafficking quantity of speed, worth $82,000, because the drug was found in the house she co-owned. Sure of herself, that was former Senior Constable Michael Holding's take on Gobbo at the raid. He took an instant dislike to her. Cross-examined in 2019, he wondered about the right words before settling on this. "I thought she felt the process was like a game. What we do know is that Gobbo's future career path was mapped out by the time her police interview concluded at 2:03 a.m. on Saturday the 4th of September. In December, Wilson was found guilty of trafficking and received a sentence of 8 months in prison, which was suspended. Gobbo pleaded guilty to use and possession and received no conviction. A good result. Bothersome, but explainable to any Law Admissions Board. Afterwards, Trevor Ashton stayed in touch. Gobbo sold pies at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, high in the Great Southern Stand, and Ashton scaled the grandstand several times to speak to her when he was rostered to work at the ground. Neither Gobbo nor Ashton could recall in 2019 why they stayed in contact at this time. She would say she was cooking chips to pay the Carlton mortgage. But within a couple of years of her arrest, Gobbo was registered by Ashton as a police informer. When cross-examined in 2019, Ashton's memories of this time were patchy. He could barely recall seeing Gobbo after her 1993 arrests, though he was forthcoming when shown his police paperwork. "That's definitely my scribble," he said, sounding surprised. Gobbo's first incarnation as an informer was G395. The undated police informer registration form from mid-1995 describes her as very good in terms of reliability. Her declared motives for informing were simple. She genuinely wants to assist police. She went out of her way to help, if the bare history is any measure. That same month, she reported to police that a Gary's Milk Bar was handling stolen cigarettes. But Gary was not her main target at the time. Rather, Gobbo seemed intent on getting Brian Wilson. Was she afraid of another conviction, or simply scared of him? She said later that Wilson was prone to drug-addled violence. The name of the police operation seemed fitting: Scorn. Police had launched a second investigation on Wilson on the 3rd of April 1995 and were keen to discuss his alleged trafficking of guns and drugs. Ashton and his subordinate, Constable Tim Argyle, met with Gobbo on the 12th of July 1995, and she updated police with information throughout that month. One of the officers who conducted the 1993 raid told the authors he recalled being amazed in mid-1995 to see Gobbo at the pub, merrily draped by detectives. Scorn was officially launched in February 1996. Gobbo introduced Wilson to an undercover officer posing as a drug buyer. She was eager to participate, Argyle would say in 2019, and when it came to using the covert operative, she was excited about that. She plucked a name for him and we had to run with it. Gobbo was getting ahead of herself, taking control. Then the operation was stopped. Wilson had sought to buy drugs, not supply them. He was not trying to get involved in trafficking. Gobbo's information had not proven useful. Detective Senior Sergeant Jack Blaney, a superior to Argyle, wrote that Gobbo was a loose cannon who was making her own arrangements and not liaising with investigators. His view, that Gobbo was unsuited to police informing, would go unnoticed for decades. Wilson and Gobbo stopped sharing a residence at some point. He moved to Queensland, then New Zealand. In 2019, he did not want to hear about Gobbo's betrayal of him in 1995. "That was a bad period of my life," he told the Herald Sun's James Dowling. "Some people learn from them, some don't." Even before Operation Scorn ended, Gobbo had been keeping herself busy elsewhere. Once again, she'd leaped by choice into the spotlight after she wrote an affidavit that became a national election headline. On the 28th of February, 3 days before the 1996 federal election, Labor Treasurer Ralph Willis fronted the media with a pair of letters, one purportedly written by Victorian Liberal Premier Geoff Kennett, as evidence of a coalition plot to reduce state funding. The humiliating discovery that they were a hoax contributed to the resounding Labor defeat that saw John Howard's Liberal Party swept to power. On the 1st of March, Labor supporter Gobbo made a statutory declaration to federal police naming the person she believed had forged the letters. Scott Ryan, known as X at the time, worked part-time for both Kennett and Deputy Opposition Leader Peter Costello. He denied the accusation and demanded to be interviewed by police so that he could clear his name, which he did. Ryan would later serve as a federal government minister and Senate president. Then Herald Sun journalist Andrew Probyn covered the story and later described the allegations against Ryan as a cack-handed and amateur political smear. To this day, it is unknown who forged the letters. A nobody, Gobbo had plonked herself in the middle of a nationwide political scandal. At the time, she was serving her 12-month articled clerkship at a Melbourne commercial law firm. When the story became public, she was engulfed by journalists, or so she told Constable Tim Argyle when she decided to drag him into her melodrama. On the morning of the 1996 election, she rang to tell him about a throng outside her Kew home. Argyle told her to drive into the city. She parked near the Melbourne Central shopping complex. As Argyle would later reveal, Nicola got out of her car and said that media was still following her. "I did not see anyone following her, and there did not appear to be any media vehicles or journalists in the area." Gobbo went dead as an informer for almost 3 years after Operation Scorn ended, but she remained friendly with Argyle. Their relationship, over the subsequent decade, was typical of the smudged boundary between her professional and social lives. Argyle was compelled to admit in 2019 that, after he and Ashton registered Gobbo as an informer, he slept with her. He explained their circa 1997 sexual encounter as a one-off romp. He could not recall how it came about. Trevor Ashton didn't know about the Gobbo-Argyll relationship, he would claim 25 years later, sounding shocked. He would have kicked Argyll off the case if he had. Every young male officer is warned about breaching the three P's principle: piss, property, and pussy. Gobbo was admitted as a legal practitioner in April 1997. Her certificate read, "And we believe her to be a fit and proper person to be admitted to practice as such barrister and solicitor." Yet her 4th of February 1997 application to the Legal Admissions Board warrants a closer look. Her sworn statement conflicts with police documents at the time of her 1993 arrest. Gobbo distorted the truth to become a lawyer. She told the board she had been unaware in 1993 that Wilson was a drug user. But how does that sit with Wilson's marijuana-filled drum, described by one of the raid officers as just, like, in your face? She also told the board she spent about 90 hours a week on campus back then. As a result, I was very rarely home at the same time as my housemate, who did shift work as a security guard, she said in her affidavit. This pattern continued for the 4 weeks we shared a house. 4 weeks? Police records from 1996's Operation Scorn suggest otherwise, as does her 2020 testimony that she pitied Wilson and took him back in as a house guest in 1995, and that he co-owned the property. Gobbo claimed in 1997 that police had told her she was being charged only because she was deemed liable on the basis of owning the house. Again, this conflicts with Trevor Ashton's statement that he found drugs in her chest of drawers. Gobbo wrote that her lawyer had advised her to plead guilty. She'd received a shock, she said, when she went to court in December 1993. She suggested that she had been of media interest as the errant niece of a then Supreme Court judge. I was approached by a reporter outside court, and I was afraid to have the matter ventilated in the papers, her affidavit stated. I had nothing to do with the drugs on the premises, and I had not asked my housemate about his activities. I certainly was not involved in any drug-related activities with him. She would not have pleaded guilty if she had had the episode over, she declared. I did so then as a result of advice received by my solicitor and the pressure of the media, she wrote. My level of maturity and my judgment of others were also factors which led to my guilty plea. In a separate document addressed to the chairman of the Board of Examiners for Barristers and Solicitors, Gobbo cited reports from a doctor and a criminal psychologist that indicate my naive behaviour and poor judgment from this time. Only 4 years later, she seemed to be saying she had shed her naivete and poor judgment. She was all grown up now. I can assure the members of the board that this experience taught me a very valuable lesson, and one which I know has provided me with a better understanding of the criminal justice system. I can assure the members of the board that upon being granted admission to practice, my integrity and honesty will not be compromised. In accordance with the trust and privilege vested in me by the court, I will endeavour to be an upstanding and honourable member of the legal profession. Her sworn assertions were impossible to disprove. A case of what she might call plausible deniability. A seasoned criminal defence lawyer took Gobbo on fresh from the University of Melbourne, at a time when ecstasy and cocaine began flooding the Melbourne social scene, and their suppliers started shooting each other. He thought she was amazing. She treated him as a target.